aren't you?
As we're winding down this 10th annual conspiracy conference in Santa Clara, California, I'm really excited to grab a few moments with Michael Tesarian. Thanks so much for sitting down with me.
Oh, no problem, James. It's a pleasure.
And it's funny, you know, when we first met, you know, Friday night, you know, we met at the bar here. And I was just happy to be able to meet you for a few minutes. And then as the weekend progressed, we started to run into each other. And then, you know, I'd see you in the hall. He's like, hey, James, let's go have a cigarette. So I've really enjoyed, I think, our time together off and on throughout the weekend here.
Well, I appreciate, you know, people like yourself coming along and showing an interest. That's what it's all about. That's what these conferences are all about. You know, getting the information out, supporting people who are trying to broadcast it. Because, you see, you may have a big message and everything, but if you don't have the platform, in other words, the speaker, to broadcast it to the world, that's completely redundant, you know. So it's a win-win situation. You have to have the information and the research, but you need the broadcasting people to get it out there to the world.
And that's, you know, the analogy of, you know, if a tree falls in the forest and no one's around to hear it, doesn't make a sound.
I'm a big believer in that, because I come from a culture in which, in Ireland, there's only like maybe 1, 2, 3 of us who are into, you know, that, the occult history of Ireland. I mean, I'm very cognizant of how America is miles and miles ahead. I know people bash the place all the time, but as a matter of fact, when it comes to this subject matter, America is rocks. You have these conventions, they have a lot to do to put them on. You know, it's a logistic nightmare, obviously. And then, you know, Brian Hall flies me out, says, you got to be here. I want you to do the second part of your talk. He allows me to do subject matter that wasn't really bookmarked under this, especially after 9/11. People were doing 9/11. They were doing all of that kind of thing and hidden government. And I've done that myself, but I have lots of other things I'm interested in. Symbolism is one of them. He let me do the talk in 2003, and it was called The Subversive Use of Sacred Symbolism in the Media. I put that up on YouTube. Millions of people watched it. You know, so it's a dynamic in which you have 200-300 people in a crowd, or even 400 or 500 at a convention, and 800,000 that month watch it. So, I mean, that's a no-brainer. And then he invites me back this time because we want to do the follow-up of that, which was a fantastic opportunity. And he believed in me back then, because, as I say, it wasn't people, see, you wouldn't think that now, but in those days, people didn't understand what's advertising got to do with any of this. So I made my sales pitch. He thought about it for several months and got back to me and said, you know something, do it, you know?
Well, and I have to say, you know, my awakening to all this was around 2002, 2003. And that talk from the 2003 Conspiracy Con was probably the first place I ever became familiar with your work. And I loved it.
That's my point.
And I shared it with folks. And I think your work and Jordan Maxwell really kind of breaks down, you know, the language and the symbolism and the words that we use. And just as you said today in your talk, you know, spell. We spell words. So you're casting a spell. And again, it's the Mad Men, the Madison Avenue men.
That's right. That was brought out by Alan Moore, as a matter of fact, the great writer and animator. He was the one who spoke about that, talking about the hidden meaning of the word spell, and you're casting a spell, and that the word grimoire is just a Latin word for grammar. You know, that there's a connection between the magical arts and just simple things that we use, like Mercury, the god Mercury, represents speech, for instance. So in other words, there's an occult underpinning. As you rightly say, Jordan has gone into this in great depth. I've done work on this. But you're right, again, by I think it was the Subversive Symbolism upload, and then, of course, this talk I did in 2012 got so many hits. But what it also did, the symbolism one was special, because it basically began infesting the net with other people, younger guys, you know, getting into it big time. You know, maybe if I had continued doing other things, it wouldn't have caught on as much. But symbolism opened a lot of people's eyes. I saw it happen with the kids that I used to teach on this. And then we saw it on the cyberspace, in which now there are so many blogs and vlogs and uploads dealing specifically with the occult, Masonic, Illuminati symbolism within movies, within album covers, and bands and music. And neither me or Brian could imagine that, you know, that day. And in fact, we were sitting that far from where we're sitting now when we discussed it. And neither he or I could ever imagine that that would happen. I mean, I had no idea that it would take off like that. And I got more emails to this day on that particular subject. And what does that tell us? That tells us something amazing. You know, that these people leave loopholes. And because all of the symbolism is split up in time and space, you don't really see it. But when somebody like me comes along and compresses it into a format, then you see these occult, you see the thread.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's non-negotiable. Then only a complete and utter retarded person wouldn't notice that there's something going on here. Pyramids, pentagrams, solar symbols, in decapitated women. You know, well, what is going on with all of this? When it's all split up in the ambiance of the world, yeah, I can understand why people maybe don't see what makes it so important. But I've been studying this since about 1980. I did a little bit of it in 1980. I got slowly introduced to it, but it was about 1985, 86 that I started to really give it a lot of thought and attention, collecting magazines, collecting logos and symbols. We didn't have computers then, of course, so it was all hard copy. And then as time went by, I continued doing it, and just it's been a constant process, moving on to then watching movies and listening to the lyrics, actually listening to lyrics and wondering what they actually mean. I've been doing since like 70s. It's always been fascinating to me what's being said in certain songs. And then my brother and I had a real fascination in album covers.
Oh yeah.
Specifically with a couple of groups like Roger Dean, Rodney Matthews, these famous album cover artists.
Uh-huh.
Of
they did a lot of the kind of the a lot of the 70s prog,
yeah.
Pink Floyd,
Yes, and so forth.
ELP.
Yeah. And then there's a group called Hypnosis, who's there. I think they're three gents from the art schools in England, and their album covers to me always were extremely aesthetically beautiful, but had a very sinister. You know, again, this is just from me. People don't need to believe it, but I always felt there was something very sinister and odd. And my background is in art, not that I'm an artist, but I've studied art history all my life. And I don't know what it was. I just started to notice it was something uncanny, something weird. Later I would know, I would be able to put language to it. Oh, this is occult, this is from this tradition, or that's Masonic, or whatever. In those days, it just was a sort of a visceral understanding that these album covers mean something. Why was this image chosen for this album? You know, why did they do that? I was really fascinated by it. And then if it was a band that also had these sort of occult lyrics, that also got me even more deeply interested. And then there's very positive bands out there who have very spiritual artwork. It's just transcendent. And that also interested me. And it wasn't until I came across the work of Jordan Maxwell, you see, that the real light started to shine and the dots started to get connected, that look at what you're looking at here is a huge industry, a very well-rehearsed, planned thing that these record companies have these art directors, and they're the noise, they're the head honchos. The art directors, you do what they tell you.
The bands aren't necessarily in on it.
The bands have almost no say, and this is in fact why Bob Dylan or somebody else will go to the length of trying to, you know, get control. Because even those guys are told, no, we're going to put on this album cover what you feel like. Well, what we tell you, not what you feel like. And the people like Pink Floyd and the Moody Blues, they wouldn't take that. They go, the hell you will. We want the album covers to go with our lyrics and concepts. Jethro Tull, you see, there's bands that just would not accept this.
And only a few probably big enough to be able to say no and get away with it, you know, as you know, the sales of a band like Pink Floyd.
But then the damage can already be done. Tony Iommi from Black Sabbath will tell you that when the first album was released and they found the upside-down cross in the album, they were blown away because they knew that their parents would go stark raving mad. You know, the girlfriends and their friends would just think, you're a bunch of Satanists. You're not a bunch of Satanists, but what's all this about? And he had to emphasize that this was the record company's deal, but the damage is already done. They're not going to say, oh, sorry, guys, we made a mistake. Let's take it all back. So maybe you change your imagery down the line. Or maybe you just go, look, we can't stop it, let it go on. But even if you wanted to change it, the damage has already been done. That people are thinking you're this and you're not. So anything you're going to say after that point becomes almost redundant. They won't hear it.
So yeah, you're talking about Black Sabbath, the first one. Yeah, that, you know, when I saw that when I was young, it's like, oh my God, that's scary looking.
Yeah, I know. So this has happened time and time again. And then what happens is people who are not going to study it get confused by thinking that really satanic bands or whatever, they lump them all together. And then they lose the discernment to say, no, just because this is an occult symbol, you know, read into it. It may mean more things than you think, but try to discern what is really sinister. So, in fact, I learned this because then I started to see that in the Duran Duran, sweet, cheesy, lovely, gorgeous, glowing video from the Communards or the Smiths, or I would see unbelievably evil images and suggestions in those poppy things.
So, like what? I'm a huge Smiths Morrissey fan. So what kind of thing, if you can recall,
no,
that Smiths was? Okay.
I can't recall specifically, but I know that when I studied it, I had them bookmarked. I mean, not the band per se. Uh-huh. It would have been whoever the record label was and who's affiliated with them.
A lot of these we're talking about are pretty much Warner Brothers, whether that's Black Sabbath, yep. or at least, you know, the U.S. distributor of the Smiths was, you know, Warner Brothers, Reprise, Sire, you know, it's all owned by Warner.
Island Records, I'm suspicious about them, you see. And then again, it's the art directors who they're calling in, their knowledge as well. It's the same complaint I have against Madison Avenue. That doesn't mean that the merchant who wants his logo cut out of Perspex or a nice design in a magazine is the guilty party. He hasn't the faintest idea what symbolism means. He believes what the Madison Avenue agent is saying. Yeah, we tried this, it'll sell. This is the color that'll sell your product. Okay, go ahead. And then they see record sales, so they're not going to complain. Which is why some of these bands go along with it in the end, because they go, wow, that really worked. But they're not ideologically in the same boat as these weird, sinister, shadowy types. But yeah, it's difficult to fight it. But you have to gain the discernment. I started noticing in the top 40s, like Erasure and Communards are using all this communistic left-wing symbolism. We know that the punks use it. We know that Sid Vicious wore the hammer and sickle. Why pick that symbol? Everybody thinks it's cool. Yeah, but it is cool. But then what's behind it? Who is Malcolm McLaren? Who does he work for? You know, so we have these... I would ask all these questions because I'm very deeply into this stuff. I want to know what these symbols mean. We see the symbol for the band Rush, you know, or whoever it might be. I'm fascinated by symbolism. I've always loved it. And I want to know what effect it's having on my mind. And then now, way down the line, I've got the language to say, look, no matter what the symbolism is out there, if you've built up the symbolic literacy, then you have a kind of immunity. So even if it turns out to be something quite negative, you know, it's not going to affect you as much as it affects the other person because you're informed. Just like I was saying at the conference today, knowledge is everything. Because all there is in this life is knowledge and ignorance. Socrates said the greatest ignorance, the greatest evil is ignorance, the greatest good, knowledge. And that's you know, you can stop right there.
In your presentation today, you discussed a lot of film and television and movies. And you brought up, well, one, the Terminator story, you know, through all the films. But what really struck me when you mentioned Back to the Future, that's always been one of my favorite movies. Loved it as a kid. I had never imagined that there was this overlay that it basically tells the story of Ronald Reagan. And that, and I recall, and I was telling someone after your talk, if you remember in the film when Marty goes back to 55 and is talking to the 55 version of Doc Brown, and he's trying to say, you know, I'm from the future. He's like, oh, you're from the future. Well, who's the president in 1985? Ronald Reagan. And Doc says, the actor?
Precisely. And movies like that are basically propaganda machines. The entertainment thing on the surface is literally that. It's just a story. Underneath it are infinitely intricate political motifs, ideological motifs, even, as I hinted, archetypally mythological motifs connecting to Horus, the relationship you see, because in the pantheons of Egypt, I know it sounds a bit odd, but Osiris has a communion with Isis. They are married. They're the primal couple. Their offspring is Horus. But in some of the esoteric traditions, Horus grows up to be basically the new father who marries with the mother. See, it's an endless cycle. It's incestual mythologically, not physically, obviously. This is hard for people to understand. And you see the same motif, which is Joseph Campbell has spoken on this. It's a well-known mythological motif of the son growing up to woo the mother. We have it with the Greeks sort of twisted it a bit, where you have the Odysseus and the Sphinx, you know. Concepts. Sophocles brought this out, but it's there in the ancient mythologies. And then you find it reoccurring in Terminator in the relationship with the son, who then goes into the future, becomes John Connor, mm-hmm. you see, who comes back, and there's all this weird interrelationship with the mother, and you're not even sure who gave birth to the son. The son gave birth to himself. Did John Connor go back uh-huh. and program the machine, etc.? And then you find it in the Back to the Future, where it's very blatant in many ways, because the son is with his real biological father is a complete and utter dweeb who is a miracle could even give birth. What happens is the Marty character goes back to save his father, not only to get his mother and father to be hooked up, that's the obvious story, but to try and give his father a backbone. And to then what is happening here, it's the same thing with the Luke Skywalker Darth Vader scenario in which the son is saving the father. What a subversive motif. Now, why would somebody do that? Is it really just a story, or is there something so much more deeply involved in that? That's when you have to pull back from the canvas and start to decode these mythological motifs of what was happening politically at the time. America is the father. America is the mother. America is getting weak. So in comes the son of the father. That's the president. He's the pharaoh. He's the king. And he's going to tell you how to save society. He's going to save the day.
And you referenced in the talk that these films sort of presage the new presidents that we're going to get.
Contemporaneous. They're either presaging it, or they are loudspeakers for the ideology of the president after he's in.
Currently, yeah.
Yeah, in order to get it out then to the people, whatever motifs that they want to get out, they will then broadcast that. For instance, the movies Die Hard, the movies Midnight Run, the comedy. In it, you have the women who are basically broken their vows, gone with weaker or corrupt men. In the Robert De Niro Midnight Run, you'll see that his wife, when he goes to visit her, she's married a corrupt cop, basically a lieutenant of the mafia. She's living in a very nice house. She has his daughter, and he's a complete outsider wearing a leather jacket, on the run, penniless, trying to borrow the car and a few bucks. What's that all about? Then when you see the movie Falling Down.
Michael Douglas.
With Michael Douglas. What's the last scene? When he leans into his wife's face and goes, was that in the marriage vows? Do you remember your marriage vows? He tries to kiss her, and she's all, you know, withdrawn and tries to save the kid, thinking he's a raving lunatic. And all he's telling her is something about morality. And then you have it in the Die Hard characters, where McClane is always making comments about his wife taking off and changing her name, going back to her maiden name, meaning, I'm leaving the hard-bodied guy who dies for others, who sacrifices himself, who can get the job done. I want a lawyer. I want a polo neck guy. I want a wine drinker. I'm going to go off for the safe life. You see, and then, of course, later on, of course, he redeems himself. Uh-huh. He's a big hero and all of that, typical Hollywood endings. But they put all these incredibly interesting motifs. All right, what was going on politically? Reagan and all these conservatives represented reanimating the morals of society. So the movies became absolutely patterned upon the ideology of doing that by reminding people of their values and so forth and so on. Whether we like this or we don't is a separate argument, right? I'm just pointing out what happens in these interesting films.
And Die Hard and Midnight Run are both 88, 89. So that's as where we've got, you know, Bush the senior.
And remember, there also are the counterpointing movies. For every other movie that is a pro-establishment, pro-status quo, you will have an Apocalypse Now or a Paths of Glory or some other movie that is also anti-establishment. So there's both. It's a balance. But then you look at the Rambo movies, which I personally very much like. Or say you look at the, the Terminator, I would say the Batman films.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole slew of films that have this very big political ideology, and it's multi-layered. Sometimes they offer you an image of the rebel. But if you really look closely, it's a faux rebel. It's a faux rebellion. It's not a true rebellion. They want the kids to identify with these models. And then these mega, mega movies that go out. Look at Star Wars. That is unbelievably laced. Now, people have picked up on this a little bit now because they've decoded The Matrix. You know, it's a little bit more genre-friendly. But in the past, people just watched this as entertainment. The Unforgiven, the movie with Clint Eastwood, is an entire commentary on the role of the father and the killer and the man who, in a Nietzsche-like way, maybe helps to build civilization. But then after the civilization is built, he becomes an outsider, he's redundant. He might become a vigilante, he might become a bandit, he might become a bounty hunter. But in earlier days, he was one of the builders of civilization. You'll get this from the movie The Wild Bunch, right through the Clint Eastwood genre, you know, of a disenchanted man who almost do what they do because they go, we got nothing else to do. You'll even hear those very terms. And Demolition Man, in the movie called The Train with John Wayne, it's an old Western, you hear this, they're going on all of these mad adventures, difficult, difficult, challenging adventures, and when they turn around and go, why are we doing this? Go, what the hell? We've got nothing else to do. And you'll hear this motif constantly. It's because the hero is a disenchanted person. After he's built society, he becomes the anti-hero until civilization crumbles, and then he's needed again. Watch The Magnificent Seven with Yul Brynner. They're a bunch of ne'er-do-wells working in bars. In fact, it's very elaborate and specific. One of the characters, acted by Robert Vaughn, is even telling you that he can barely get a meal. They overcharge him. He has to sleep in the back rooms for filthy hotels. They're always on the run. And these are the samurai.
Uh-huh.
And because The Magnificent Seven was based on the Seven Samurai. It's Kurosawa. It's ancient legends. They've built civilization. Civilization doesn't need them anymore. Your choice is either die and go to the boot hill or just, you know, work as a day laborer. or as a cowhand or whatever. And the Magnificent Seven is based on this. Except, again, when civilization is breaking down, right? The random element, the bandits come into the village, threaten the civilization of the village, threaten their crops. You'll always hear this Osirian agricultural motif about the crops dying. It's a very Arthurian motif. It's a mythic motif. You now have to go and handle these powerful warrior-type people, bring them in temporarily. They do their number, but remember, all the men in the village warn the women not to marry or even have any interaction with the guys, the seven Americans. And in fact, when they come to the village, the women are in hiding. So you have these motifs in which these guys are needed to perform a function, like a form of surgery, but nobody should interact with them. Then after the job is done and they've killed the pestilence, they're asked to leave. They're no longer... They need to ride on. And at the end of that movie, the Yul Brynner character and the Steve McQueen character make it very clear, yeah, we don't have a home. We always move on. We are always the losers.
Mm.
Then when you see Rambo being sliced up in the Rambo movies, you always have flashbacks of him being knifed.
Mm-hmm.
So even though he's got the perfect hardcore body, he's the perfect warrior, they're also showing you a level of vulnerability. This body can be pierced. This body can be hurt. That both makes us fearful that, oh my goodness, you tell me the hero is vulnerable, but it also gives us a great sense of euphoria when he conquers it. In fact, film critics know that in most films that involve the hero, there is in fact a ritual wounding or a ritual beating. If you look at the Fistful of Dollars movie, they beat the living crap out of the Clint Eastwood character and they break his hand. This hand-breaking motif can be found in umpteen movies.
And I was just going to say, you know, Luke loses his hand.
Yeah, or Darth Vader does. Oh yeah, you're right, that's right. Luke loses it and gets it put back on. If you go to the earliest Irish mythologies, I mean, 5,000 years BC, the king loses his hand.
Hmm.
The king of Ireland, in a great battle, loses his hand. And there's a whole other sub-mythology that takes place where he has to go around and get it fixed. So these are all recurrent motifs that exist, partly Nietzschean, partly mythological. And
well, what would be...
The ritual wounding, to finish that part. And by the way, in the Magnificent Seven, in order to heal... not in the Magnificent Seven, but in the Fistful of Dollars, for the Clint Eastwood character to heal himself, he's driven out of the village in a coffin.
Hmm.
Remember, he's dead. He's not wanted.
I haven't actually seen Fistful
And then he
Dollars.
Goes into a mine. It's a motif of the underworld. And there he builds his hand up again. He perfects his shooting. And he comes back out armored with an armored plate under his cloak.
Okay,
this is
now
purely
that I'm
mythological.
Familiar with.
This is purely mythological.
Which shows up in Back to the Future 3.
Exactly. And many other films in which the descent into the underworld is Tiresias, the wounded hero. In fact, there's not in any mythology in Greece, in Rome, and wherever, Egypt, the hero never enters the underworld without a ritual blinding or a ritual crippling, which is often a... allusion to castration, by the way. Right, but anyway, what happens is the hero goes in and then he rises again as an invulnerable creature because he's gone through the underworld, just like you see in Lord of the Rings. They have to go through the land of the dead for the king to really come to his kingship. It's a very recurrent motif, and then he comes out invulnerable to fight the greater evil that exists, and then after that he has to ride on. You see this in the movie The For a Few Dollars More, in which they parody High Noon, in which he says you need a better sheriff, and you see him as the man with no name, meaning he's not part of society, riding in on a wet day, a wet evening. He has his little interactions in the city, and then you see him throw the badge of the sheriff down, say you're corrupt, and ride off again, you see, into the wilderness. So these are the people who they come and they go. Crocodile Dundee, the same thing. He comes into the city. He's part of New York. He's totally an outsider. He's got so little technological ability, he can barely change the channels on the TV.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a benefit to him? Yes, because he's able to defeat evil because he doesn't know anything about technology. He's pulling out giant crocodile knives, you know, to these gang members and stuff. He's an innocent, but at the same time, he's undefeatable. He's wily. He's part of nature. Crocodile Dundee. He's part of the natural matrix. He's able to save the day. But what does he do afterwards? He goes back to the place from which he came.
Mm-hmm.
These are continual motifs. So in other words, the interactions between the male and female characters, the interaction between any children involved and their relationship to these people, the interaction to bureaucracy. If you study all the three Rambo movies, you will find that the only time that John Rambo ever shows he's always angry to the point where you'll see him killing. But if you look at his face, he'll be stoic. When he's killing other soldiers or he's in a battle or conflict situation, there's barely an expression on his face from the first movie to the second to the third. The only time that he actually roars with anger is when he's in the room of computers with a bureaucrat. The only time that Rambo shows visceral anger, raging, and his guns are just blazing, and people haven't even noticed it, is when he's in the room of the bureaucrat with all the computers, this Judas, who's totally sent them on deathly missions, who's corrupt to the core, who's lying to the media. So in other words, he can be in a combat situation and just stoically and almost reverently attack his enemies, and the only person he's angry with is a bureaucrat. Watch the Clint Eastwood sagas about the bureaucracy that he has to fight. He's always, you know, having somebody breathing down his neck. No. Die Hard, most of the movies have this motif in which the bureaucracy, the red tape, and then the hero's heroism is that he goes the distance. He will break, he will either leave or go on his own. Death Wish is part of this. All of these films in which the person has to break through the rules that constrict you in society. In other words, he's got to move from the safety zone, become the hero again. Everyone needs him, but he needs nobody. He leaves the confines of the normal, is and somehow wounded, in, or one of his family members is murdered or killed, like you see in the Death Wish, or abused, mm-hmm. or the Vigilante movies. And then he goes through his heroic performance. He'll meet his initiates along the way, who will initiate him into manhood. This is very well brought out in the movie with Steve McQueen, Nevada Smith, which is very much a rite of passage film. It's brought out beautifully in the movie Once Upon a Time in the West, except for the hero is a heroine, Jill.
Okay.
Yeah, but I didn't want to start analyzing that film. It's incredibly deep. So in all of these movies, there's this transition. But the most important thing is often the anti-heroes are bureaucrats. Killing other people and having to go through obstacles and fight fellow cops and evil little drug dealers and stuff is mostly incidental. What all of these movies are pointing out is that there is an incredible web of bureaucracy which is the real demon. You find this in umpteen movies in which when they finally find out who's behind this, it's some corrupt politician, some corrupt mayor, and some lord or king or what it might be.
Mm-hmm.
The overclasses, you see, that prey and create these dichotomies, and the hero is lost. All the end, most of the end, first of all, Dirty Harry and Death Wish, they never have happy endings.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there may be a resolution, there's no happy ending. And also, the camera will often pull back, and you'll see these characters in isolation, walking on a lonely road at the end, or even in the beginning, because he's an outsider. He's not part of the system. These are incredible motifs, and they all have their archetypal... they're scripted from archetypal motifs that are sometimes thousands of years old.
They've all studied their Joseph Campbell.
They've all studied that, and the Mircea Eliades, and the Jungs. And again, they studied literature. It's in the literature. I don't know if people know this, but the... how many umpteen movies, some of the most beautiful and famous movies that we know, are based on the writings of Thomas Hardy, the great novelist, who was the first novelist to ever make it happen where external weather mimics or represents the internal temperament of the character.
Hmm.
This was never done in literature or in any art form before. He was the first one who said that if it's rainy and stormy outside, rainy and stormy things are going on inside the person. If it's sunny and bright, better things are going on. Well, this has an enormous value 5 minutes later when other writers pick up on it. Then you have the German expressionists who took that to its ultimate extension, in which the entire ambience in which you live is nothing but a reflection of your inner landscape. Hollywood liked it and went, we'll borrow that. And since the German expatriate after the war, all those directors had to go to earn a living in Hollywood, they brought those motifs with them. They didn't get any
budget. Fritz Lang,
Murnau, and so many others. Carl Freund, who made the Mummy.
Oh, okay, yes.
See? All these geniuses, not only that, but even Joseph von Sternberg, who made Marlene Dietrich famous. You have many directors who came over there. And what they weren't given many budgets, so then they had to go for more like horror movies. That's where the Dracula movies came from, and the Mummy and the Werewolf, because they couldn't get the big budget. So you have all this magnificent cinematography and interdynamics of psychology, which wasn't even discovered until 20, 30 years later, when other directors like the Scorseses go, hey, that's brilliant, and brought new light. But by that time, the actors and the directors had perished in miserable deaths, and nobody paid their work any mind.
And those were the film school guys, the first generation of film school guys, Coppola and Scorsese and Spielberg and Lucas.
Grew up on those people, Francis Ford Coppola, Rumpelfish. You know, all these movies are actually made based on earlier movies. They can't stop doing it. But nobody can do it better than those guys. I mean, how many people know that the movie, you know, Frankenstein Meets the Werewolf is entirely about psychic dynamics, about the relationship between the conscious and unconscious mind, the ego, the superego, and the id? Hmm. How many people know that outside film criticism? Film critics know about it. Well, how many people know what the dynamics are within Psycho or Vertigo or Marnie?
Yeah, there's a lot going on in Hitchcock.
It's just entertainment.
Uh-huh. It's a popcorn movie.
It's popcorn.
So I was going to ask you, what would be the contemporaneous movie that mirrors the Obama administration and the coming of Obama?
I have lost track of that. I would say a lot of things, and it's probably even more so in the little cartoons, like the things that are all fashionable now. It will be in the movies, but it will also be in more sitcom fashion. They've changed dynamics a bit. It's in the big mega busters.
But a lot more folks are maybe just watching YouTube and shorter things and cartoons, right, and all that stuff now.
So it'll be in South Park. It'll be in a lot of these more soundbite type things. Of course, it's all in the news programs. I mean, the psychophantasm is amazing. But it is a study. It doesn't go away. It was invented by Sergei Eisenstein, the communist who worked for Lenin. Mm-hmm. You see these people? He invented it. It just got picked up by the Americans. Mm-hmm. It's implicit in montage. It's implicit in everything to do with the moving of the camera and the interdynamics and relationships. And we need to know about it. We need to know a little bit about it. It's very fascinating because it helps people, even those people who want to go on and make their own films and documentaries and movies. They need to know about this one way or the other.
And that's, you know, my background, and I have a degree in mass communications. And, you know, 101 is talking about Bernays and propaganda. And a lot of these things that you learn, again, early on studying these things, even in just a mainline university, is you realize very quickly, none of these things are an accident.
How many blondes, how many blonde women from the earliest days of Hollywood? That's just an accident, or just because it looks good on silver nitrate film? No, I don't think so. There's an occult reason why that type of female was used, and it is deeply, not only is it rooted in occultism, it's rooted in various forms of Satanism, by the way. It's actually a principle, an icon, that is absolutely standard within certain very powerful satanic cults that run the world. Now, they're more shadowy, and they are part of the Illuminati matrix, but they have a different ranking. And they're elusive, and their job is to work behind the pop icons. They work in the media. That's where the word media comes from, by the way. It refers to a cult of sorcerers who originally were very positive people, mm-hmm, until they got co-opted. To work behind rock and roll, to work in the advertising industry, and to insinuate their ancient, beloved symbols into the modern ad copy. Billboards, movies. We don't notice it. We don't know nothing about it. They could be spelling it right out in front of us. I keep trying to show examples of this, about how obvious it is. Did you hear what he just said there? Did you notice in the Da Vinci Code, when the cardinals of the Opus Dei are crossing his forehead, he doesn't make a cross, he makes an L. Hmm. What is the difference between an L and a cross? Does it matter? What does it matter in James Bond movie when he says you need to get on the plane to go to, your plane is waiting, we've sent you on the mission, you have exactly 3 hours and 22 minutes to get there.
3-2-2.
Do we notice that the James Bond offices of M are designed to be a simulacra of the Great Pyramid with a Queen's Chamber, that's Moneypenny's Chamber,
huh,
and then the King's Chamber? Because you very rarely see Bond walking up the hall to the building. You just see him coming into these two mysterious chambers, different sizes. Anyone realize that that's the interior of the pyramid? Meaning, not the pyramid in Egypt, but the Illuminati pyramid? You're in one? Who, yep, is James Bond? What does the lion head mean that's on the hat stand? What does the double doors between Moneypenny's office and M's office? What does M stand for? Why is all his room decorated in maritime symbols of ships? You know, the whole thing, the 007s, do we know that that goes back to Queen Elizabeth I and to Sir John Dee, one of the most powerful black magicians that ever lived on the planet? His code name was 007. I brought all this out of my work. You know, it's an incredible Dionysian cult. I call them the Dionysian cult. They can also be known as the cult of Aphrodite Venus. You have a statue of it standing on Ellis Island. Only she's under the name Diana Lucifera. But it's exactly the same thing. And I mean that Lucifera, Diana Lucifera, meaning Diana of the Light. It's a goddess icon that is central to occult and other permutations in satanic ritual. And you're seeing this on umpteen movies. I have a long list of them in my other work, Age of Manipulation, which is a free upload. You know, you can hear a part of the story, a tiny little. Time is always limited, so you can't get into these things as much as you'd like. But on that, in that particular series we did this year, I tried to go into that a bit to show just how powerful these cults are. And if we don't know about them, and we're giving money to buy their products or their albums or go to see their movies, not only are we suffering psychologically, we may be even funding them. Because there's one really interesting thing about movies and the music business. It makes loads of money. Not only is it known to be a money laundering circuit, but it also brings income to these cults. So I'm not implicating every movie, nor am I implicating every transgressive movie, say like a Fight Club or whatever. There are brilliant movies out there that I adore. But you have to also realize that there's just as official media critics know that even in very positive movies, you'll have brand placements, and it's ubiquitous. In fact, it's sometimes really in your face. I mean, I don't mind. How many times do they mention Taco Bell and Demolition Man? Like 10 times or something? Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying anything more mysterious than that. These motifs are put in the way that I'm saying, in exactly the way that a normal, everyday film critic understands a product placement is put there. But they don't include the pyramid, solar symbols, ravens, doves, pentagrams, or whatever it might be, phallic objects, black horses. Mm-hmm. Please go and watch all the detective shows you can imagine, dating from as far back as when they created them, and any movies that you can think of, and look at them and tell me if you cannot find a black horse, at least one. Starting with James Bond, going through, I don't know, Columbo, Rockford, linking Starsky and Hutch, pick whatever you want.
Kolchak or...
all the way from the beginning to the end, through some of the biggest mega movies, and just notice, just do me one favor, notice how many times you will see, either on a painting or on a statue, a black horse. That's it. Just observe that one symbol. Watch Tomb Raider. You know? Watch Surrogates or whatever it might be. And you will continually see the repeat same motifs. The number 23. The number 322. I can't even list it. My talks are handicapped because, look, I can't even list it. No. There's not even enough time.
When you mentioned, you know, some of the writers and some of these critics that we're talking about, film critics, media critics, and you had the list, you know, of folks like Vance Packard, and at the bottom of the list was Douglas Rushkoff, someone whose work I admire, and I have probably most of his books on my shelf. But as you said, they're able to break it down all the way until the point where they don't see the occult overlay.
And more specifically, they won't address secret societies, probably because they know they'd be out of a job in 5 minutes. The publishers won't publish their books, and they'd be like me, just ranting and, you know, hanging around and, you know, doing my little thing, right? They want to go down that corporate road, right? So you have to obey certain rules. I don't do it, so I don't have to obey those rules. Or they just may not know. They just may not know. Or they may read their audience and go, if I say this, they're going to think I'm ready for the funny farm. I'm already laying on them subliminal suggestion. What am I going to tell them now? That there's a cult of sorcerers from ancient times doing it? You know, it's not going to happen. So, you know, you have to have the right context as well. I like their books and I support it because, of course, it's perfect for the beginner.
Yes.
Because that's the thin end of the wedge. If you can understand that the subliminal content exists, you are now a good step away to learn more. Not everybody will continue the research, but some will. And I reach that audience all the time. I reach that audience all the time because you cannot answer. I mean, anyone who's familiar with my work will know this is a no-brainer. The symbolism tells you. The symbolism is in your face, right?
And we, as you and as Jordan Maxwell have said, you know, we need to become symbol literate to be able to see and be able to read these signs and, you know, the semiology and all of those things. I guess, as maybe we should probably start to wrap it up here, and I really enjoy talking to you. It's been a pleasure to meet with you, like I said, and hang out with you, you know, this weekend. What are some of the things that you may have coming up and maybe in conjunction with RedIceCreations.com, Architects of Control?
Well, I'm doing Architects of Control 2, and I got two other DVDs coming out. I had to put some of the projects on ice because I wanted to commit to Brian Hall. He wanted me here, and I was in the process of doing these, and they put on ice for a couple of weeks because it was important to be here. He was, like I said in the beginning, he was one of my earliest supporters. He took a risk, And so I can't say no to him, you know. So we came and did this talk. But yeah, the Disciples of the Mysterium, which is the same content looked at in a slightly different setting. Different, you know, you change the focus a bit, look at the same conspiratorial information from a philosophical side and also an existential psychological side. Then I got a thing called Trees of Life DVD coming out, which is a continuation of a theme that I addressed in the Irish Origins of Civilization, but couldn't get into in great depth. And by the way, it ties perfectly into what we're saying, because I go into great detail about the cult of the female, both the redhead and the blonde, and her and the real sacred reason, the true depth of the symbolism that surrounds the female and why it's sacred to religion and why it's been skewed in these satanic organizations I'm talking about. What was its purest form? And that's a look at that, a very deep and elaborate look at that, tying into the idea of what the Druids and how ancient people saw the goddess and the feminine principle.
Mm. There's so many things that we could continue to talk about, and I'd like to extend, you know, the opportunity to continue this. You know, we can do interviews over Skype and keep kind of growing this.
I'd love to do that. And don't forget, I got the public forum, and I also just recently got my own YouTube account, because there's so many imposters out there with my name. But I got my own now. It's Unslaved Films. So we're uploading tons of free stuff there. Every day or every few days, we're always uploading new things, interviews and so on.
So that's youtube.com/unslavedfilms?
That's it.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Michael Tesarian, MichaelTesarian.com. I appreciate it so much, man.
Thank you very much, James. It's a pleasure. Cheers, mate.
MediaMonkey.com is your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies and cover-ups. Featuring weekly radio shows on the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.org, the New World Next Week video series with CorbettReport.com, plus special interview episodes, B-sides, mixtapes and so much more. Send news tips to MediaMonarchy@gmail.com. You can make a donation or mail media to the Monarchy at P.O. Box 12165, Portland, Oregon 97212. Thanks to all the internet and community radio stations who broadcast these shows, and most of all, thanks to you. Remember, don't hate the media, become the media.